Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Now we're going to start 2 minutes early because I'm going to do a little remembrance of events past. I first met Kwan Lu, who's our first speaker tonight, at La Trobe University in August 1973. When I turned up at a speech which Mr. Kwan was doing, he was then the counsellor in the South Vietnamese Embassy in Canberra and had been invited down by a university club with which I was not associated to give a speech at lunchtime on Vietnam. And I turned up a bit late. I had another commitment and found that Kwan was being confronted by a very violent demonstration with people burning flags inside the lecture hall and imminent physical assault. So he never got to give his speech, but we looked after him, took him up to my office. He gave a press conference to the media and then got him out of the office. It was very violent and the students ended up pulling out the fire hose, and it was very nasty. And Kwan never gave his speech, but I went through my old files the other day, and my old file from 36 years ago, the Trobe University Kwan incident, and it's all documented. So what I'm going to do tonight is to give our first speaker not only a copy of the media reports in the Australian, the Melbourne Age, and the Melbourne Sun, and an apology from La Trobe University's pro-vice-chancellor, or acting vice-chancellor, but also a copy of the speech you never gave. and which has subsequently been lost to everyone except me, and Anne, who presides over these long-held files. So I'm going to say to Kwan, well done. You made it. Here's your speech. The great thing about that moment of enormous intolerance is that Anne and I went on to run the Sydney Institute, and Kwan went on to head ABC Radio. SBS Radio. And of all the demonstrators, I went through all the notes today, I mean, none of them made an impact anywhere. But I think a few became graduates of Pentridge Prison. I think they graduated there. I've already introduced Kwan Lu, our first speaker, former head of SBS Radio, and our second speaker, Dai Lei, community relations coordinator for the Liberal Party and a former broadcaster and producer at Radio National, at ABC Radio National. So we lead off with Kwan and then we go to Dai Lei. That's right. We're fine. Okay. So both our speakers will speak about 15 minutes each and then we'll take questions and discussion.
Thank you, Gerard. I'm not confused. I don't know which speech that I should deliver. because I returned to Australia as a refugee. I lost everything, so I certainly very much thank you for the gift, and they are certainly very invaluable to me. But first, I'd like to pay tribute to the original owners of the land on which we are now gathering, and also to acknowledge their continuing living culture. I also like to thank, Sydney Institute and many other distinguished guests. All of you are certainly distinguished guests, but I also like to thank the leader of the opposition in New South Wales, Honourable Barry O'Farrell, Mr. Charlie Lin, my very close friend, Stephen Kekasherian, who was my predecessor at SBS, and he has run the Community Relations Commission for many years, and also many other
business.
And also the former Premier Nick Reiner. He has done a lot of work for many communities, including for the Vietnamese Australian community. Thank you, Mr. Nick Reiner, the Honourable Nick Reiner. Now I'd just like to start my presentation, and I have to cut it short because I've been written this time more than I should as last time at 33, 34 years ago at the La Trobe University. So but I'd like to start speaking with an anecdote. In 1996, there was another chair, not like Jira. When I held up the Austrian banner, seeking the floor to deliver my remarks, the chair of the meeting looked at me hesitantly, didn't know whether I was in fact Australian or I was sitting at the wrong place. But in the end, he called Australia for me to deliver the speech, which I did. Then after that, a member of the Chinese delegation, a member of the delegation of the People's Republic of China, smilingly rushed to me and say a few words in Mandarin. Of course, I was not skillful in proof of why the Prime Minister gave it right. So I did not understand. So I say, well, thank you, but I don't understand proof of why I don't understand Mandarin. I am an Australian of Vietnamese background. So I say, oh, so you're not Chinese, but congratulations anyway. So this is very ordinary. This is very ordinary sort of occurrence. Many people attending international conference would know that, and diplomats certainly have many more very interesting story to tell, like this to learn more than that one. But Australia, by then, have had about 20 years, two decades of embracing multicultural approach, starting with the changing of the Migration Act in 1966 by Prime Minister Harold Holt, and then the burial of the White Australia policy in the Whitlam years, and also, importantly, from the Vietnamese community, the Australian community, the testing, the bold testing of the public tolerance by the Fraser government when that government dealt with the Indo-Chinese crisis by accepting large numbers of asylum-seeking Asians. But I guess by then, the fundamental change in the Australian social fabric did not manifest itself to the extent that Australia could be seen to be represented overseas by an Asian like myself. Of course, in the last 10 years or so, there's emergence of Vietnamese of 1.5 generation, the one who was born in Vietnam and grew up in the country of resettlement like Australia, and you are going to hear Dai Le, she's in fact one of them, because she came to Australia when she was 11 years old, and she's now a very successful, I think, and going to be successful, 1.5 generation of Vietnamese Australian. But thanks to that sort of emergence of the 1.5 generation and also the second generation, it's now almost commonplace for Vietnamese Australians attending so many conferences and seminars. So it's not anything exceptional anymore. But Vietnamese is not a migration, not a migratory people. So we don't have the migrant experience, nor did we have any tradition in migration like the Chinese. What we have to do is to try to learn from Australians of many earlier wave of immigration. And that's what I did when I returned to Australia in the mid-1935, after the fall of Saigon. My first journey to Australia was in March 1970. As a diplomat, as a counselor at the Embassy of the Republic of Vietnam. And I came to Canberra in March 1970 when Long Ngo, General Long Ngo in Phnom Penh, waged a coup d'etat and changed the policy of Cambodia, which allowed the Vietnamese and the U.S. Army to fight the communists in the eastern territory of Cambodia. And that certainly gave impetus for the so-called anti-war movement in Australia. And then, as you know, the matter was become very much difficult, much worse, with the shooting of the student in May 1970 at the Kent State University in the U.S. Then 4 days later, I flew to Melbourne to witness the aid, to witness the May, the 8th May 1970 rally, where Dr. Jim Kang was whipping up the sentiment of the professors in terms of anti-Australian engagement in Vietnam and also anti-conscription. I believe when I saw the face of people, and I thought and still think now that the intensity of the emotion was so much stronger than, say, in the UK or elsewhere, mainly because of the conscription issue. And I thought I fully understood that because Australian mothers have every right to ask their government to bring their sons home from Vietnam, because I was myself as conscript, and my mother spent many sleep at night worrying about myself, even though I stayed for a short period in the army, in the Soviet army. The task that I was asked to do was to try to inform the Australian public. So I went out, tried to lobby the media, politicians, students, and everyone else who cared to listen to me. I also spoke and took part in the debate at universities. There are many of them, there are hundreds of them, but most went through without any incident, so they're not reported. But I got very bad experience at three particular occasions. The first one was at the University of Queensland in September 1970. The second one was at the University of Sydney in June 1971. And the third one, which is very important to me, was at the La Trobe University on the 8th of August 1973, where I first met a very talented, upcoming teaching political scientist by the name of Gerard Henderson. Even though we're at that time, I did not have the opportunity to deliver my speech. At Queensland University, I was prevented from leaving the university premises after my speech under the pretext that I did not answer all the questions, which is true, because I did not answer the question, because, say, one of them was, what did you do in 1975, puppet, when Ho Chi Minh fought for the independence of Vietnam? I did not answer the question not because of being sold, because somebody called me a puppet, but I did not answer the question because it was a silly question. I was born in 1940. Then the police came to my rescue after, but I had left, and so the matter left for the Vice Chancellor of the Queensland University then, who was Professor Zeman Cohen. Question number one, the question, the issue of the university is a free, as an area for free speech. And number two, whether police have the right to enter the university. Then at the Sydney University, it was the same thing happened, but there was no police involvement. When I start speaking halfway through, the radical elements in the room started to disrupt, and some of them rushed to the rostrum and tried to subject me to physical violence. So Professor David Armstrong here, who was a philosopher, a well-known philosopher, had to cancel the meeting. And Professor Peter Lawrence, many of you may know him, he's a very famous Australian anthropologist, he drove me in his car away from the university. And then the worst one was, in fact, at the La Trobe University, when, because even before I start speaking, the 200 or thereabout of so-called students, many of them were not in fact students, but majority of them were student, radical students, they passed a motion denying me the right to speak and asked me to leave. But once they'd done that, they prevented me from leaving and tried to attack me. And that's why I was given refuge by Gerard Henderson in his office. And I'd like to quote a report from the Australian that Gerard referred to. And I got it from the internet by an academic. I think Fry wrote an article about the left behavior in terms of free speech in Australia, and he quoted this from the Australian. And it says that when I was in the room, the student occupied the door and then start screaming abuse and banging the door. And then after that I was rescued again and left without making the speech at all. So the other three incidents that I remember very well in terms of my going around in Australia, talking to people and debating on the issue of the war in Vietnam. I think the left was very very skillful in terms of their propaganda. And one of the very successful myths during the war was that this was a war of liberation by the local people in South Vietnam, and it has nothing to do with North Vietnam or China or either People Republic of China or the Soviet Union. And it was very difficult for me and for us, the South Vietnamese, to try to counter that kind of argument because of the sentiment, the emotion involved in the issue in Australia. You may remember I actually do remember going around in all cities of Australia, seeing on the wall for peace in Vietnam, recognize PRG. The Provisional Revolutionary Government was in fact a political creation of North Vietnam. To give legitimacy to the National Liberation Front of Vietnam, which they created in 1960 for a seat at the Paris Peace Talk, which led to the Paris Agreement in early 1973. During my time in Australia, there was another failure that I'd like to share, and that is our inability to influence the Australian government in terms of our survival, in terms of the survival of South Vietnam. You may remember in 1972, Henry Kissinger flew to Saigon and tried to force President Thieu to sign the Paris Agreement, which allowed the 14th Division of North Vietnamese Division to stay in Vietnam, where Australian and American had to leave. We were against that line of agreement, and we said so to Henry Kissinger, but we need support. But none of the other allies of South Vietnam, including Australia, support us. Ambassador Phuong, who was Vice Minister Phuong, who was ambassador to Canberra before, went to see, came here to see Foreign Minister Nigel Bowen on Friday the 3rd, November 1972. I remember very well at his office at Martin Place in Sydney. I remember that very well because I was with him to see the minister. And the minister was assisted by Ambassador David Anderson, who was also former ambassador of Australia in Vietnam. But we got only a good hearing, but nothing else. We tried to get in touch with the Governor General, Sir Paul Hastler, who, as Secret Minister for External Affairs, was one of the main architects of the Australian-Vietnam policy, with big well success. So there you are, we were very isolated. So in the end, South Vietnam had no choice, and Mr. Tran Van Lam, who was then the Foreign Minister, had to sign the Paris Agreement on the 27th of January 1973. And the rest is history. In mid-1975, Tran Van Lam returned to Australia as a South Vietnamese refugee, and so did I. I was in Saigon on the 30th of April 1975. I had to escape on a bamboo basket floating in the Gulf of Siam and was picked up by a Thai trawler. But when I returned to Australia in late May 1975, I was given 6 months temporary residence because the Whitlam government did not like to resettle refugees from Vietnam. And I was only given permanent residence in early 1976 by the Fraser government. Then I was very, because I don't have much more time, so I'd like to mention two things. I was very fortunate to have come to Australia and be accepted. I was working at the Department of Immigration and Affairs or Multicultural Affairs. I was state director here in Sydney, and in that capacity, I was able to return to Australia, what I was very indebted for the assistance. And also after that, I succeed Stephen Kachikarian as the head of SBS Radio, which was the best part of my life here, because in that position, I had the opportunity to provide information, education, entertainment to people that matter, to people that matter to them, the information that matter to them, to enrich their life or to change their life. But there's another, the institution, the FBS, enjoys very strong independent intermediatorial methods. I represent FBS many times overseas. One of the most difficult parts for me to explain to some of my counterparts in Asia was the fact that why SBS as a government national broadcaster and yet independent of the government of the day. That is a concept that's not been understood by China or by Vietnam now. And also, we're talking about the freedom of speech. I was once criticized by a government senator in the Senate at the Senate Estimate Committee hearing because that was in early 2004 because I took part in the K demonstration at the Bondi Beach against the government unlimited detention of children. I was criticized very strongly, but I refused to accept that criticism on the basis that I did so in my own capacity as a private citizen and also in my own time on a Saturday. But the point I'd like to make is that the reason why I was criticized because that protest was organized by a leftist alliance, and that might have attracted the attention of the senator. To me, it's irrelevant because I was only interested in the issue. So here I will take 1 minute to conclude. and that is that Prime Minister Kevin Rudd has said, and before him, Prime Minister John Howard, Paul Keating, Bob Hawke, and Malcolm Fraser have also said that Australia is a great democracy. Most Australians agree with them, including myself. I am privileged to live here as a citizen. But a great democracy can be even better when the majority does not ignore the needs of the minority and where we can be caring for the socially disadvantaged, such as our indigenous brothers and sisters, and for those victims of human rights violations in search of a refuge. I believe that the benefit derived from such social advancement and a compassionate approach to people in need of protection will not only be consistent with our laudable tradition, but also enrich our society. And I also believe that our society is defined not only by what unites us, which is obviously important and fundamental to our future, but also in finding solutions to issues which may divide us, solutions unaffected by short-term consideration and solutions we can ground out. My journey from Vietnam brought me into contact years ago with abusive left-wing radicals who saw me as a right-wing diplomat. And then later in life in Australia, I was attacked by right-wing politicians as a left-leaning media executive. I was neither. I strongly believe in what I'm doing. Thank you very much.
Now, I ask both our speakers to keep their speeches brief, and that's what's happened. But Anne will run the full papers in the Sydney papers, and I should also say that Kwan's story, I think, as I recall, was written up in the Bulletin. You wrote the story in the Bulletin in 1975, and also you told it to Radio National a couple of years ago, so we'll put those links on our website. And so now we come to Dai Le, who's going to continue Vietnamese journeys. Thank you.
I'd like to acknowledge my leader, our opposition leader, Barry O'Farrell, who took a very courageous step in endorsing me at the last by-election in 2008. I know that Nick Greiner isn't here as well. Oh, there's Nick, former Premier of New South Wales. Quang Lu, former head of SBS Radio. Gerard Henderson, Managing Director of Sydney Institute, Charlie Lin, MLC, my colleagues at the Liberal Party, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Gerard, for inviting me to speak here today and to share with you my journey from Vietnam. The topic, the subject, has triggered memories for me of my actual escape, my life here, my identity and my current journey. So to begin this journey, I will take you back to that fateful day in April 1975. In April 1975, when the war ended in Vietnam, my life changed forever and my personal journey began. I had turned 7 and was on my little tricycle in front of our yard at home when a group of soldiers ran through the gate, yanked me off my bicycle, rushed into our house and grabbed my mother and my sisters. My mother had one small suitcase in one arm and my little sister in one, and our maid, who we had come to call Auntie, carried the youngest sister. We were bundled into the back of a small military ute full of fearful-faced grandmothers, crying mothers and screaming children. The next thing I remember, I was running. My little legs were trying to keep up with my mother and Auntie. We were not alone. I recall seeing cone hats bobbing up and down in amongst the tall grasses. People were rushing toward a big grey metallic ship and we scrambled to get on board. We were fighting to make sure we were not left behind. Panic was in the air. As the ship pulled out, I turned around to take one last look at my beloved Earth country. I remember vividly till this day the decision I made then as a 7-year-old. Everything was destroyed. I had lost my home, I'd lost my father, my grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins and friends. I felt all alone and wondered if I'd ever return back home again. I looked at the departing shore and saw total destruction. People left behind, distant explosions, the sound of helicopters flying above and cries and screams. This was the last memories I had of my escape from Vietnam. For the next 3 years, my family and I lived in limbo. We landed in the Philippines, where the ship brought us, and lived in displaced people's camps. There, we were supposed to wait for my father, who I have since gathered worked in some intelligence capacity with the Americans. The hope was that he would join us and then we'd resettled in the US together as a family. But my father never came, and after 3 years of uncertainty, of living in overcrowded and poor conditions, my mother, a woman who spoke very little English, at the age of 33 with 3 young children to care for, made the courageous decision to escape one more time. So at the beginning of 1979, my mother, Anne Lay, decided to join 32 other Vietnamese refugees to take one last chance of finding a safe haven and future for her daughters. On a small rickety boat, 36 of us waded through the warm waters in the middle of the night on a shore somewhere in the Philippines and set sail again. After nearly 10 days on the ocean, a Hong Kong patrol boat finally pulled us in. We stayed in Hong Kong refugee camps till the end of 1979, when Australia accepted us for refugee resettlement. I was 11 years old. It will be 30 years on December the 5th, 2009, since we've called Australia home. Nowadays, sometimes I ask myself, who am I? I've spent nearly 3/4 of my life in Australia, three times longer than I spent in my birth country in the years of escape. Has this particular reality, this long journey, given me a truer identity? Have I now developed a sense of belonging? Our first home is in a free and democratic society was in a small town of Fairmeadow, a quiet suburb close to the beach in Wollongong. Besides the first white faces that greeted us at Sydney's Kingsford Smith Airport, the next group of white faces that greeted us and welcomed us was the St. Vincent's de Paul Society ladies group. They welcomed us with cut sandwiches spread with Vegemite and sprinkled with hundreds and thousands, as well as ham and cheese sandwiches and canned pineapple. We will forever owe our debt and gratitude to this group of loving, warm and caring people. One of them, Claudia Smith, who lives in Bulai with her wonderful husband Don Smith, this year received an OAM for all of her charitable work in helping to resettle many of the early arrivals of Vietnamese refugees. When we first landed here, I remember making the decision that I would embrace everything Australian and that I myself would become an Australian. And with the help of Uncle Don and Auntie Claudia, I couldn't wait to be accepted as Australians, like them. For me, that meant I had to learn the English language and adapt to this new home and the new way of life as quickly as I could. I had to study hard, to be diligent, and to make myself part of this society. I even decided it was no point learning the Vietnamese language at language schools because I didn't think there was a need to know that in order to survive here and to fit in. Australia at the time had just opened its door to Vietnamese refugees. The primary school where I attended in Fairmeadow had five Vietnamese refugee students, including myself and my two younger sisters. The rest of the students were, in my eyes, pretty much the same, white. There were a few European background students whose parents were from Italy, Macedonia, Malta and Greece. I do not recall our background, that is being a Vietnamese refugee, Italian migrant and so forth, was ever a subject of discussion or was an issue. Yes, we shared our life story and experiences, but I wasn't made to feel nor needed to prove the point that I was a refugee. I was a refugee, but I became an Australian with a refugee background. I felt that in the playground and with my friends, I was a new kid on the block and soon became an ordinary Australian girl whose best friends were Jody and Susan. Jody's parents were of Scottish background, while Susan's parents were Italians, her mother being a second generation Italian. So what is being an Australian today? One way we could look at it is we are Australian by declaration. And as a nation underpinned to a large extent by migration, we as a nation and as individuals within this nation enjoyed a rich cultural heritage. A small sense of this is shown by a recent ABS survey which showed the top five languages other than English spoken in Australian homes are Chinese, which includes Mandarin and Cantonese, Italian, Greek, Arabic, which includes Lebanese, and Vietnamese. So I won't go through the figures, but there are some figures that came out through the ABS which shows the five largest groups. But for me, the operative word is being an Australian. So imagine how you'd be experiencing life at the moment if you were planning for your holiday, say, after a year of hard work. You'd be experiencing excitement, a sense of relief, looking forward to a break. So it is a moment you've been waiting for. For me, that is how feeling or being an Australian is. So being an Australian for me is being appreciative of what I have in this country that I came to call home since I was 11 years of age. It is about being respectful and courteous to people you come into contact with, meet and associate with. It is about being passionate and compassionate. It is being hardworking and striving for the best. It's being responsible for your own actions and words. It's about being true to your word and being willing to contribute to society and community in which you live. However, I would also like to acknowledge that there are still pockets within our society where people have not been lucky enough in their day-to-day living to experience the depths and layers and opportunities that a culturally diverse community can offer. I believe it is the role of our educated, informed and visionary leaders within the political, educational and business arenas to engage and connect the people they represent with the wider Australian society. I believe where multicultural Australia has failed in the past is in the lack of vision from our leaders to communicate and create a future where everyone can share in celebrating its richness. Instead, the M word has been used, sadly, for political gains. The Labor Party has successfully tapped into this area and has somehow claimed multiculturalism for their own, leaving the Liberal Party to be perceived as a party that doesn't embrace diversity and one that doesn't accept multicultural Australia, especially under the Howard years. And yet, it was under the Liberal government of Malcolm Fraser, and I think he has not been acknowledged enough, that the Vietnamese refugees were resettled and given a new start in life, a second chance. My story is not unique. Mr. Liu and many other Vietnamese Australians share a similar background. Political refugees are by definition forced out of their native countries, while migrants choose to leave. However, refugees like myself would like to acknowledge that Australia has a generous history of accepting people who needed sanctuary. That my new life was possible and I'm able to stand here before you today to tell my story was due to the support of the then Prime Minister, Mr. Malcolm Fraser. As I mentioned earlier, it was the Liberal Party that many Vietnamese refugees like myself were given a chance to start a new life. So while Australia was still dismantling elements of its white Australia policy, which I know that Harold Holt began in 1966, I have to acknowledge that Mr. Fraser's decision at the time was courageous and caring. And no doubt it was a difficult step to take, including for the leader of the Liberal Party, of which I'm now a member. I would like to say that the journey from the beginning has not been easy. It has been a traumatic experience, especially on someone so impressionable and so young. Not one boat journey, but two. Hunger, illness, death of loved ones, kindness and cruelty. I saw it all with my young eyes. There has been a struggle with language and adapting to another culture, learning to eat Vegemite sandwiches, which my five-year-old loves, lamb chops and scones for one. Australia is now made up of many cultures. It is a fact we all have to acknowledge. Our differences should be celebrated and not be feared. Our differences should be acknowledged and shared. And out of this learning can come understanding and knowledge. Knowledge dispels fears, according to Charlie Lynn. My request for many Australians, migrants and refugees like myself, is for us to step up and embrace the greatness that Australia and her society has given us, to find a way to create a bridge that will connect and engage with those who've been here before us. What matters now is what we make of ourselves, of the democracy that we found here, and how we can contribute to it. For political and ethnic leaders, I think it is time to depoliticise our approach with ethnic communities. I have the same needs as you when it comes to my child's education, or how to access the health system, or how regular my trains run. Those days of block voting and block campaigning should disappear. It does being multicultural Australia no justice. My son calls himself an Australian, but he has German and Vietnamese roots. I have enrolled him into learning Vietnamese. He's eloquent in English. When he reaches a voting age in about 13 years' time, I'm sure it will not be based on his ethnicity, but I know he would vote based on qualities of the leadership, vision, policies, and humanity of the political party, and I hope it will be the Liberal Party. My vision is that our leaders will recognise the vast talent of young people of non-English speaking background and the richness of the cultures underpinning their families. Otherwise, we will be vulnerable to exploitation by those small groups of people in our society who do not believe in the greater goodness of humanity and use ethnicity as a dividing force. I think that the election of Obama in the US shows that racial background should not be an obstacle to participation in society. The World Wide Web has broken down many cultural and communication barriers. Its growth and phenomenon is no accident. For too long, people are confined and defined by the color of their skin, shape of their eyes, their ability to speak English, and so forth, to be able to be part of a society. The World Wide Web has eliminated many of these barriers. Australia is indeed a very unique society. We are unique. I am unique. You are unique. The uniqueness is our identity and should be celebrated and shared. I would like to end my journey, it hasn't ended yet, it's just beginning, in reality, a Machiavelli quote in The Prince that says, "There is nothing more difficult to plan, nor more dangerous to manage than the creation of a new order of things."
Thanks. As I said, the full papers will be published in the Sydney papers and the talks will be up on our podcast tomorrow. And so we come to questions and discussion. There are a couple of seats there, if those who came in late. So now we come to question and discussion. Alison. Now, I think if you... I think if you direct the question to one person, whoever can come up to the... to the microphone here. Yes.
My question is to Pandu. I wonder if you could fill out your narrative a little bit by telling us what happened at that time when you were supposed to be on the Australian delegation to Vietnam.
Thank you. The question is, what happened at the time when Quan Lu was supposed to be on an Australian delegation to Vietnam?
Well, thank you very much.
You talk to the back of the room.
Yeah. Thank you very much for the question. I don't expect that anyone could remember, but you do. In 1993, I will take one step back. Before the election that Prime Minister Paul Keating called the sweetest success of the Labour Party in 1993, Gareth Evans came to SBS Radio, and one of the questions asked by one of the journalists was, "You, Foreign Minister, you promised to have a delegation, an Australian delegation, to go to China. If the Labour Party wins the election, would you do the same thing to Vietnam?" That was before the election. So he said yes. Then after the election, someone remembered that answer and reminded the foreign minister of his promise. Then Gareth Evans negotiating with the government in Hanoi for a long time until the end of 1993, when he got an agreement to send an Australian parliamentary delegation to Vietnam, among other things, to discuss human rights. That delegation was supposed, or in fact it was, led by Senator Stephen Loosley, with the Labour Party Foreign Affairs spokesman by the name of Alexander Downer. Huh? Plus one or two academics. I think the academic was Then there was a suggestion that the delegation should have also Australian or Vietnamese background. So Gareth Evans' office contacted me. I was then head of SBS Radio, whether I would go. I said I'm quite happy to go. So I was included in the delegation. Then we went to Canberra for the briefing and so on and so forth. Then they asked me also to submit an application for visa. And that application for visa, I had to detail why I left Vietnam. I said I refused to do it. And Senator Loosley said, "Okay, well, just close your eyes and pretend not to see anything and do it, otherwise the delegation could not go." In the end, I did apply for the visa. Then 2 days before the delegation supposed to go, I was interviewed by the BBC. So I said, this is the background. The delegation is a parliamentary delegation. I'm honored to be a member of that delegation. And the question was, what the delegation would do in Vietnam? I said the delegation certainly would do many things, including going, seeing people who are subject to human rights abuse. And it was monitored by the government in Hanoi. So they canceled my visa at the last minute. In return, and I believe that to his credit, Foreign Minister Gareth Evans also canceled the trip, because they canceled my visa, Australia canceled my trip. A year later, I met...
Just a quick finish here.
Yeah, a year later, I met Gareth Evans in Melbourne. I asked him why, in his view, why that was happened the way it was. Happened the way it is. And he said there was a fighting between the foreign ministry and the security ministry. The foreign minister was Nguyen Kham, and the security minister was General Lê Văn Hưng, and security minister won the day. That's why the foreign affairs in Hanoi lost, and that's why the delegates could not go. That's the answer to the question. Thank you.
Thanks. Anne.
I wanted to ask Dali about her going back to Vietnam. Could you tell us what it was like to go back, how you felt, and
question
why you went back?
Question about Dali going back to Vietnam. How did it feel and why did you go back?
Okay. I went back for the first time in 1996. And I went back with foreign correspondents. So it was a very emotional journey. It was the first time I went back after leaving it in 75. So discovering my grandmother and finding her, and that was very emotional. And I've been back since, most of the time for work, as I was working at the ABC. So I've done quite a few pieces for ABC TV and radio and BBC. So a lot of the time I've been back there for work. And of course, because my relatives are all there, it's going back to see them, and it's great. It's really a great, for me anyway, great place to be, and seeing how my family live and contributing to making sure that they have actually good life still. Yeah. Sorry, it's
official.
Question
here.
Hi. Just another question. I wonder if you could just fill us in some more about your education, how you got a job as a journalist, and also perhaps what happened to your mother and your sister.
Ah, okay. I moved up from Wollongong and lived close to Cabramatta in the 80s, and I finished my high school HSC, and then went and did a cadetship for Fairfax Community Newspapers out in the Fairfield, Liverpool area, working and covering the Cabramatta area. I just noticed a colleague of mine at the back there, Julia Newbold. And then from there, I went back to university, I got into law for 6 months, or 3 to 6 months, and I dropped out because I found it boring. Sorry for the lawyers in here. So I went and got a cadetship, worked for the local papers in print journalism, and then went to university studying part-time, working full-time at Macquarie University doing political science. And then after that, being such an ambitious young person, I thought, 3 years at Fairfax, it's now time for me to go into the ABC, because I thought that's where I can learn to, the national broadcaster. So I resigned from Fairfax thinking, they'll open the doors for me, but it took 12 months. But I eventually got to the ABC, worked at television and news and current affairs. I set a 30 report, working with Kerry O'Brien, Late Line, Maxima Q, worked with her, produced her, I worked on a couple of Four Corners stories. So, and then got a cadetship, worked as a reporter, The World Today, AM, and PM. And then after about 12 months of the cadetship, after that you apply for positions within the ABC, and news and current affairs wasn't for me, because I wanted something more about engaging and connecting with people and getting their stories. And so I moved into documentary making, radio. So that's how I got into Radio National. Yeah. And my mum is in my family still lives out in Cabramatta. My sister next to me is one of, I don't know her title, but she's a manager within Telstra. The third one has moved over to Indonesia and lived there with her partner and two kids. And we've got an adopted young sister who is gone to studying university teaching at the moment. Yeah.
Question down there.
I think during the when I was working at the 7:30 report, I tried to, you know, use the International Red Cross to search for him, and it was very difficult. I think we waited. I actually did the search, not we, because my mother said don't go there. So I did, and for 12 months, you know, they said they couldn't find anything, and I gave up at the end of 12 months because I thought, oh. Because whenever I discuss it with my mum, she goes, why do you go back and dig up your passport? Why can't you just leave it behind? So I thought I left it. But I think, you know, yeah. I thought I gave it my best shot to search for him, and I did through the internet. Maybe I didn't, I don't know, but it's through the International Red Cross, and nothing came out of it. But so it was quite scary because you don't know what you're going to find. And, yeah.
Can I ask Con? Thanks. You had, I mean, a truly heroic escape. I think you went by through the water from Vietnam to Thailand, and you got back into Australia. But what was your problem with Gough Whitlam? Because he was Prime Minister, but not at all welcoming. Now, Peter Walensky, who you know was head of the Department of Immigration around that time and worked for Whitlam on his personal staff, so he was involved at both ends. He once said to me, look, Gough Whitlam wanted Vietnamese, he just didn't want any communist Vietnamese. And of course I replied, well, there weren't any others who wanted to come here. So was that your problem? Was it just you're an anti-communist Vietnamese?
Well, the short answer is yes. I'd risked my life, went through the checkpoint and so forth on the second, on the 1st of May 1975. Went to the Mekong Delta, and then I took the boat to an island called Pulau Bangsang, which is about 200 kilometers south of the fishing port of Rasia. And then from there, I was floated out in the Gulf of Siam on a basket. Most people will remember the Vietnamese being called boat people. I was an exception. I'm a basket person.
A basket case.
A basket case. Then I was brought to Samut Sakhon, which is the fishing port west of Bangkok. There I was put under house arrest because of unauthorized entry by the Thai police. I stayed there in the house arrest for a week. Then I convinced the policeman to go to Bangkok with me, which he did and allowed me to do that. Then I cabled my family, who was then in Canberra. And all of my friends tried to get me, because up to that point, that's about 3 weeks after the fall of Siam, up to that point, nobody knew where I was, whether I was dead or alive. So when they received the cable, I have so many friends in Canberra, and they tried to work with the government, to put pressure on the government to get me on to Australia, which I did. I came to Australia in late May. But I was given only 6 months temporary residence. And other people also, and myself included, had to promise not to be involved in politics. In fact, Tran Van Lam, who was the first Vietnamese ambassador to Canberra, also got that undertaking. I believe the reason why Mr. Whitlam did not like to resettle South Vietnamese, because he thought, perhaps not wrongly, but not certainly rightly, that Vietnamese would become like Asian boats, that the people from the Baltic state, and will perhaps as a group would support the Liberal Party. So he refused to accept Vietnamese on the basis of humanitarian ground. But his decision, I believe, was perhaps influenced by the long-term consideration of the political, from the political perspective. Well, he would deny that, but I think the fact that he said he didn't like Asian boats in Australia was well documented, and I think you have that documentation to prove it. Then the reason why I became an Australian citizen and got permanent residency that because of the 11 November 1975 event, and the Fraser government gave me Makela, Michael Makela as Minister for Immigration, gave me the permanent residency status, and then I became an Australian citizen.
Thank you. Question here. Yep.
That was a great talk. How do you feel now about Vietnam? Are you proud of its achievements, ashamed of its authoritarianism? Would it have been better if Saigon had prevailed?
First I'd like to say that I'm not trying to fight a war that ended 35 years ago or 33 years ago. So I have to say that clearly. My view of Vietnam now is that it could have been better. We all accept that after the change of policy in 1986, they embraced it, they basically followed the Chinese road, tightly controlled politically and liberalized economic activity. Number one, to survive. Number two, to give the population something to look forward to and perhaps not to be anti-government. But the last part of your question is the one that I'd like to say, and that is that whether the situation might have been better had South Vietnam not been defeated. I'm biased, but I say yes, it would have been better. For the reason. The myth during the war was that the North Vietnamese government was the best government, the disciplined government, the pure government, the non-corrupted government, where the South Vietnamese government is the corrupted and the victorious. The fact of the matter was, South Vietnam was not a one-party state like the Socialist Republic of Vietnam now, which is a one-party state. The fact was that South Vietnam did not control the media, as the SRV now controlling the media. And the fact was that the members of the International Press Corps in Saigon could go to anywhere, interview anyone, and anyone in the view can express his or her view. If that's not the characteristic of a democracy, which is even an imperfect democracy, then what is it, I don't know. But to answer the hypothetical situation, whether it could have been better, because now, 30 years after winning the war militarily, what the government in Hanoi is now doing is in fact they're doing exactly what the South Vietnamese government did before 1975. Their slogan then was to fight the Americans to save the country. Their slogan now is to go to the USA to save the party.
Okay, so we're about to... I think we'll have a final question here, but yeah.
Mr. Liu.
Well, then it's the second one. It's got to be brief. I'm going to ask the last one to die. Yeah.
Be very brief.
Yeah.
The dominant theory, I believe, was the raison d'etre for the Vietnam War. The communist terror would sweep the home and end up in Indonesia. In view of the Vietnamese underlying dislike of the Chinese, do you believe that it's a valid theory?
Well, you're talking about the domino theory. Of course, after the fall of Saigon, the communists did not march to Singapore or Malaysia or Singapore or Indonesia. So a lot of people say, well, that domino theory was wrong. I beg to be different in the sense that because we are talking in two different time frames. In 1954, when the Geneva Convention divided Vietnam into South Vietnam and North Vietnam, Singapore, Malaysia, Indonesia, and the rest in South Asia were not or had not been as they were in 1975. So had the communists won not only part of Vietnam but the whole lot of Vietnam then we might have seen the domino theory to be realized or to be happening. But because to the detriment of South Vietnam and to the detriment of the South Vietnamese people, that the people in Southeast Asia have time to develop, have time to consolidate their institutions, have time to improve the living condition of the people. So when Vietnam, when South Vietnam was defeated in 1975, Southeast Asian countries were too strong for any dream of the North Vietnamese to try to conquer. They did, because in a limited way, they did, because they occupied Laos before the end of the war and after the end of the war. Laos has never been independent because they were under the occupation, military occupation by North Vietnamese. That's why Laos now goes to China to counter that occupation. And they also, as we know, are fighting two wars, the war against China, which fit into what you said, because there's the enmity, there's hostility between the Vietnamese and the Chinese historically. But they also fought a war in Cambodia from 1979 for a decade. People who were against the war say that there should be peace because a lot of people were killed. Dr. Jim Kane used the phrase silence kill in one of his books about the little about the demonstration in Melbourne. But it should be noted that silence did kill as many people in Indochina at peace as it did in Indochina at war a decade earlier. So I think, get back to your question, my answer is that when we look at the domino theory, we have to keep in mind the two time frames, 1954 and 1975. 20 years, that is breathing space for other countries in Southeast Asia to survive. Thank you.
Tyler, you ran in Cabramatta, you did very well, you got a big swing, you didn't win. What was that experience like, fighting an election in a democracy? Are you inclined to do that again?
It was a very awesome experience, and politics wasn't something that I had considered at all, so it was quite new. I just used my skill as a journalist, which is to engage and to talk and to listen to people, listen a lot of the time, listening. So would I do it again? Yes, I'd do it again. Does that answer the question?
Yeah. Look, it was a wonderful night. Many thanks to both of you for telling your own stories. You're two generations, different genders, and you both got Vietnam journey stories, and it'd be great for Anne to publish them in the Sydney papers. They'll be up on our podcast tomorrow. And for tonight, thanks for talking from the period of the of the 70s and into the 80s, and what you've been doing as you've been both been very successful settlers and citizens of Australia. So well done tonight, and no doubt you'll tell more stories in the future. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again.